You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 513. Welcome back. This is the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White. I'm recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on tonight's show, Mr. John Gentile out of the United States of America. Hello, John.
Hello, Adam. How are you today?
I'm good. I have a question for you, but it involves a little bit of Doctor Who timey-wimey shit. And also joining me is our fantastic youthful news editor and more out of somewhere north of me, Ontario. Hello.
Hello. How's it going?
I'm okay, but really the question is John okay? But this is a question John can't answer because we have a couple episodes to kind of pull back the veil here that are in the hopper that need to get out. And those episodes will get out over the next few days. But what that means is that this episode that we are recording is going to post after the United States presidential election of 2020, which means that as we record this, we do not know the outcome of the United States presidential election 2020, but the listeners do. So there's this dramatic irony thing that's sort of happening to us where we don't quite know what is happening. So maybe we're all chipper because good things happened, or maybe we're all kind of dour and pissy because bad things happened, and maybe good things or bad things happened differs based on your personal politics, listener. Although maybe not, because I think we've driven half of you off. So I don't know. I feel like we should say something, John, about the historic event that has definitely happened, but we don't know what it is.
Well, Adam, history is important, and if you don't know your history, you are doomed to repeat it.
Would you say, John, that time is a flat circle?
Yes, I would.
Were you surprised when dramatic last minute thing X happened on, I don't know, Tuesday?
Man, I was like, wow, I can't believe this is happening. I mean, people said it wouldn't happen, but in the back of your mind, you're like, well, maybe it will happen. And then it happened, Adam.
I know. Mean, wow. I couldn't work. I kept hitting the refresh button. And wow, there was events in world news that happened that are significant.
It's among some of the most significant events of this year, I'd say.
I mean, they are definitely events that happened this year, whichever they are and happened were.
Yeah.
So anyways, there we go. We addressed it. Any mail, anything you want to talk about?
Yes, you can always reach us at podcast@punknews.org. We love getting your mail. And let's see here. All right. First letter is, I always plan to have the mail open and I never do. Here we go. No. I'm sorry.
No.
I'm blowing this.
I should also preface this whole thing that it is like a day or two before Halloween, so maybe we're all feeling kind of spooky, but I don't know if the listeners are going to pick up on our general spooky vibe or if they're just going to think things are weird. I don't know.
I just finished the Ramones special. I liked it that you all looked at the Ramones outside the first four albums. But the first three are classics for a reason. Even so, I feel like you touched on the surface and didn't really dive into one particularly period very deeply. Maybe in the future, when you do special episodes, you can focus on one album alone and really look into it. Good job anyway. And that's from Frank.
Did you just say that the Ramones special that we purposefully didn't focus on the classic albums had a flaw and that it didn't focus on the classic albums?
I think Frank might be of the opinion that even though there are non-classic albums, we shouldn't focus on them. I don't know. You know.
I mean, hey, what are you going to do? You have a band that's like that big and has that much career. Yeah, we could have done probably a whole episode on, you know, fucking Brain Drain or something like that. But hey, you know, there's only so much that we can do on the very, very little prep that happens on this show. So really, if you take like a decade and a half of time, there's enough cursory knowledge that we can fake about that we can talk about it for 2 hours.
And well, actually, you know, that's the thing is so much of music journalism is faking. Like if, let's just say Pitchfork says to somebody, like, Jim, you know, write a history of the late 80s punk scene in Hollywood. Then Jim will go, like, research it and stuff and like, write what appears to be that he's extremely knowledgeable. But he's really only writing about the exact things that he discovered and not the vast that he didn't discover. And so there's – and everybody does it. I mean, that's kind of how you have to do it, you know? So everybody in music journalism acts like they're an expert, but nobody is, Adam.
Except us. It's weird because the true deep dive is a fairly rare thing, and everyone's been desensitized to the fact that those don't happen all that much. And it's probably a matter of time and money that they don't. I mean, so to plug my own shit, I write this music newsletter that is immensely popular. And I went and some band sent me their record the other day. And the way that my newsletter works is that, like, I basically like mention new songs and stuff that come out. It's the punk news rhythm, but I just do it weekly, right? I'm not deep dive analyzing. I'm not analyzing anything. I'm not reviewing anything per se, right? I'm just sharing that this thing is out, and, you know, I might comment on it for a sentence or two, but that's it. And that was basically what I did here. You know, band X has song out. These are the people that played on the record. And then I maybe threw a sentence in there about why I liked it or whatever. And then I moved on, and I got an email from the person that was like, well, thank you for the review. I'm glad people are digging it. And I'm like, I wasn't really a review, but, like, I mean, I'm glad you're happy, but I don't know. Like, I feel like a review would involve way more engagement than I gave your stuff, but they just ran with it. So yeah, a lot of the times it is that.
Okay, and this is from Kyle, who's written in before. What's cracking, punk news podcast crew? Record buying topic for you. What do you think of pre-order timing these days? I'm seeing labels and consumers battling with each other over pre-orders lately. Labels are selling their vinyl pre-order ETA times unrealistically, and then buyers are dragging them for not having the records yet. I think this can easily be handled by constantly providing updates, but regardless, everyone's still complaining. I see the scenario a lot with hip-hop projects. They hit the streaming services one day, followed up with a vinyl pre-order, and then the vinyl arrives over half a year later with no customer service provided while vinyl communities go irate. On the other side, the hardcore band Gulch didn't release their album until they had records in hand, and they sold out overnight when the record came out. I guess I'm wondering this. Do you think it's irresponsible for labels to take pre-orders and hold your money for half a year waiting for your record? Is it possible to pre-order a record and your money isn't drawn until it ships? Or do you think pre-orders need to happen closer to records arriving? Big love to everyone, and thanks for the epic – you're quite welcome, Kyle. Big love to everyone, and thanks for an epic episode 500.
As you were reading that question, I went back and forth three times on my opinion.
Well, here's my opinion. It's always good to deliver updates. I do think record consumers are a little bit more – well, actually, they're way more demanding than they used to be. I mean, back in my day, in the 90s, if you mailed for a record, you might get a record back in like 4 months, you know, if you got it at all. You know what I mean? And so now people are usually getting a record that week or next week. I don't think it's really possible for record labels to – take pre-orders after the record is pressed because records are so expensive and because no one buys records these days, and that makes the dynamic of record manufacturing very dangerous, because if you make 300 and you might sell it right away, which is bad because you should have made more. But then if you make 500, which is another, roughly speaking, $2,000 or $3,000, if you only sell 300 and you're stuck with 200, you just wasted all your money and you lost money, even though it was a significantly popular project. So pre-orders before the record goes into production is necessary for the label to gauge how much they're going to sell and also to get the money on hand. I mean, if this was 1997 and people were buying records like crazy, I would definitely agree that pre-orders are a waste of time. It's silly. Just print the record and sell it because you're going to sell them. But unfortunately, these days, no one's buying music. Bands aren't making any money. And so people want the convenience of Spotify and Amazon and all that garbage. So this is the price. Is that the pressing, the time between the pressing, the pre-order and the pressing and the release is extremely extended and variable, especially in the COVID age. Should the label give people updates once in a while? Yes, but I think once a month is more than enough, honestly. People want updates like every week. It's like, well, you're going to get it when you get it, you know. But it says John, who Punk News Mixtape number 2 was delayed by like 9 months. So that's my opinion.
Em, you got a read on this?
I'm not recording right now. I'm looking into getting a record player, but I don't have anything right now. So I think whatever works best, and not everything's instant gratification. You have to wait for stuff. So updates once a month sounds good. Very fair.
There's definitely an overboard that you can go to where you stop looking like a credible person and you start looking like everything is off the rails. And so, just, I mean, to take this completely out of recording and just recording, I think you've now put that in my head. Great.
I think that's a cool phrase. I'm recording.
To take this out of vinyl mail order and put it into like another context. So we deal with a lot of tech shit and in my day job. So we had some issue where we needed to get like an engineer from Microsoft to be involved. And they got involved like 2 months ago and they took a bunch of info from us and sort of like took it overseas to whatever call center, you know, in some other part of some other hemisphere that Microsoft actually does this. And then it vanished. And it was clear to all of us that it vanished because there is no real answer to what we did that these people could find out. But what they have done is just taken it, completely lost the plot of what they should have been doing about it. But because it was some sort of corporate policy, they email us every day. And every day the email is like, hello, we are still working with the engineers on your problem and hope to have some information to share with you soon. But every day they share that message, it is reworded just slightly. Like as if they like had to go through and look at yesterday's message and like hit every word with a thesaurus to come up with a new message so that it sounds like someone's actually doing something. And it got to the point where like a week ago we emailed them and we're like, never mind, like it's fine, we've moved on. But that hasn't registered, and we still get one every day that is a slightly different one. It's become like a big source of pain in my office to get this daily email from the Microsoft help people. So you can absolutely go overboard with your updates for things if you have nothing legitimate to say. I think that what matters here is track record. And this maybe applies more to a small label than it does to a band. But if you're a small label and you can reliably make a release happen, then and you know that people are going to buy a certain amount of them, then you can absolutely do the pre-order thing and take that money earlier. And I think that the people that buy it from you or whatever, or that buy your product, are going to understand that, you know what, you have delivered in the past, you will deliver in the future. Sometimes this stuff takes time, especially these days, and that's going to work. I don't think that you can necessarily play that game if you're some completely new entity and you're trying to just use the pre-order to bankroll the whole thing. Like, I think at that point you kind of have to eat it and, you know, take it out of pocket a little bit to make the thing happen, just to prove to the rest of the universe that you can make it happen before you ask people to trust you as their bank. So, you know, you gotta decide how much trust you want to draw upon your listener. Now, if you're a band and you want to do the pre-order thing, I feel like the same applies, except that it's sort of reverse, where if you're one of these bigger acts and you know that there's going to be a certain amount of sales for your shit, I don't know if you need to draw out the pre-order that long. Like, if you're fucking Pop and you're going to put something out, then put something out, because you know, X thousand people are going to buy it one way or the other. Like, you don't need to trickle that out over the course of months. So it's here or there. It's here or there.
And you can always reach that podcast at punknews.org. We love getting your mail. Podcast at punknews.org. We love getting your mail. Dun, dun, dun.
Email. Sorry. I'm very excited. Oh, God. All right. All right. So what are we doing before we move on to the rest of the universe right now? Did you want to play a song? Em, you got a song? Something you want to play?
I do.
Do it.
So, because Halloween's kind of coming up.
Nope, election is happening, but whatever.
Oh, right. Well, but
that's okay. It's Halloween. It's still Halloween here.
In our hearts, it never left. There's a punk band out of Dayton, Ohio, and they're called House Ghost. And they have kind of like a horror-y sort of thing going on. So I'm going to play Widdershins by House Ghost, and that's off of their self-titled album that was released earlier this year, so...
House Ghost, and we're back. We're going to talk about some of the stories that happened in this past week. So the first of which, and again, given the time, you listener will know the impact of this on the American populace. But Descendants, they've released two songs on a two song single, which they are calling Suffrage. The songs are On You and Hindsight 2020. Now, if those are familiar, it's because they are. These are the full band versions of songs that Milo did on his solo ukulele EP Rebuke about a month ago. But these are the actual like full band Descendants versions of them. You can stream
one song is a full band Descendant. The other is fresh.
Oh, okay, sorry. The other is fresh. There we go. So they're available digitally right now. They will be available on a 45 at some point. So this is the band's first real follow-up to the 2016 record Hypercaphenum Spazinate. So you can find both those songs linked up on Punk News or on YouTube or wherever you go. They're probably everywhere right now. So John.
Oh no, I'm wrong. I think I'm wrong. I think they are both DeSantis versions of Milo tracks. I'm wrong. I take that back.
There you go. There you go. There we go. So end of discussion. Move on to the next story. John, any thoughts on these two new DeSantis songs?
Yeah, well, I was surprised by the punk news community reaction. Is Milo's Uke versions, which I thought were cool and interesting, got unanimous hate. Unanimous. And then everyone's like, oh, this is so great. I'm like, it's the same song. The only difference is it's a guitar instead of a ukulele. I can get saying, yeah, John, I don't love acoustic as much as I love electric, which I agree. I like electric way more than acoustic. But I'm astounded that the same people talking how terrible the songs were now just because their guitars are like, oh, this is so great. I can't wait. Oh, always good news. These songs rips. It's brilliant. These are the same people that were trashing the exact same songs as before. And I generally, like, honestly, like, whenever a song is super political and people are like, oh, these lyrics are weak, or I don't really like this, or this seems like a misstep to me, it's clear that they're really just disagreeing with the political aspect and not the music or even the artistic aspect. But here, that doesn't seem to be the case, because it's the same exact people that hated the Milo version that now love the DeSantis version. I think the DeSantis versions are good. I will always say, hey, I think it's cool that the DeSantis are being so political. A lot of bands, when they get to middle age or even later middle age, punk bands, like, you know what? Let's not upset anybody too much. We've got our fan base. That's what pays the bills. Let's just do music that we know our fan base will like. Whereas here, the DeSantis are being explicitly, they're explicitly choosing a side. And I like that. And I even like it when a band might choose a side and I don't even agree with that side. Maybe not in the instant case, but in general is what I'm saying. But I do agree with the DeSantis side here, of course. And so I think it's cool that they're doing that. I think it's a relatively bold move. Not super bold, but in the bold arena. And I think these tracks are good. I think for me, the best DeSantis will always be Milo Goes to College, because the production is rougher, the songs are a little bit punker. But I dig this. I think this is cool. And I think Milo and the rest of the band is feeling inspired. And actually, if you read my Milo interview at Punk News, you'll see that both Milo and Milo and Stefan have written an album's worth of material, but they're waiting for Bill and Carl's contributions. So I thought that was somewhat surprising, and no one seemed to care. Bro.
What do you think, Em? How does the Descendants sit with you as a young person? Do they have the same... Yeah, by the way, I'm going to keep doing this, and I'm referring to you as a young person.
That's okay.
It's a curse. Do they carry the same weight when one of their new things comes out, or?
Well, I think so. Like, for me, it does, because I really like the DeSantis and all the. It's so nice to see like bands actually putting out stuff that's like good and that they're trying. You know, and they're like. They haven't kind of resigned themselves to just, we are a greatest hits band now. They're still being active and they're being creative and they're still like, they're taking a stand and they're showing, or like not their true colors, but like they're showing how consistent they are, I guess. Like if, you know, someone comes out and in support of, like saving the trees and, you know, they come out in support of that and they keep doing that their whole like career. Like that's really something else. So I appreciate what they're doing and I hope they're going to do more. And I'm looking forward to their new album whenever it comes out.
I'm trying to decide how I feel about the comment that I saw from a few of the Punk News people that they weren't sure. They commented they weren't sure how well these songs were going to age. Right now, of the two, so On You, it doesn't have any direct political direct like references to anything that's happening in the news that are in it. Like there's some evergreen things that are brought up in that song. There's some 1984 references and stuff like that. But the song Hindsight 2020 is absolutely about this year, where they're mentioning, you know, immediate happening things. They're mentioning MAGA and all this other stuff, right? So, and on the one hand, I was wrestling with like, you know, does that does that matter how well that song's going to age? But what I always come back to is I always come back to like California Uber Alice, right? Which is a song that should not age at all because there's a bunch of direct references to like Californian gubernatorial politics in that particular year that show up in there. And, you know, no one should be able to connect with that, you know, in any which way if they weren't alive in, what was it, like, what was it, 1979 or whenever that song came out. So no one questions that. So I'm not sure why people would be questioning that about a Descendants song that is about something that is much wider, which is, you know, a presidency that happens to affect the entire world. So that just, it seemed like a weird take for me to see that crop up a couple times. And I don't know, when I see that take come up, it seems like maybe a swerve, like maybe a comment where they're saying, you know, I wish this artist that I like wouldn't have dipped their toe into politics that I don't choose to get involved in. And that's code for, you know, that's the code for basically that they're swapping for saying, you know, oh, how's this going to age? I don't know. Not sure. Not sure how I feel about that read on. But neither are y'all, so whatever. Here we go. John, do we have anything else to say about Descendants?
They're cool. I dig them. Milo is extremely intelligent. The whole band's extremely intelligent. And they're a band that hasn't made me require myself to reckon with who they really are, a la John Lydon, which I'm still working through. And Rob Miller of Amoebix. And what, there was one other guy. And Ice Cube, of all people. That, to me, that's almost the most shocking one, is Ice Cube. Ice Cube! Man.
That's true. Milo hasn't had the mess with us in that way. I mean, like, Milo's biggest crime is that maybe he writes too many songs about farts. And and that's something that's a little bit easier to deal with. All right, so moving on here. So, Spotify is a service that some of you may subscribe to. It is a thing that allows you to stream music. So there is a organization called the Union of Musicians and Allied Workers, and they it includes, quote, music workers, including musicians, DJs, producers, road crew, and others, end of quote. So they've joined together to try to fight for the rights of musicians and related causes. And they have recently launched a campaign, which is called the Justice at Spotify campaign. And here's what they're demanding. And this is something that, given the numbers that Spotify currently pays out, is pretty radical. So they are demanding a per stream royalty rate of at least 1 cent paid via a per user-centric payment model. I'm not entirely sure what that is. They are looking for transparency in contracts and deals with labels, which is to say that some of Spotify's deals guarantee favorable terms to majors at the expense of smaller indie labels. They are looking for the elimination of payola, or play-to-pay arrangements, on Spotify's curated playlists. They want listed credits for all labor involved on the recordings to show up in Spotify. And they want an end to lawsuits targeting artists. End of quote there. So the current Spotify licensing model is described as a pro rata system to assign portions of the total royalty pool generated by paid user subscriptions and ad dollars to rights holders based on the portion of total streams the work they own generates. And we can get into that a little bit in a sec. So a ton of musicians that you know have voice support for this campaign, like punky ones in particular that you may want to know from this show. You have folks like the Downtown Boys and Ted Leo. You've got Fugazi's guy, Picciotto, and Sheer Mag and stuff like that. So anyways, this has been really floating around on social in the last few days. They are trying to drum up some... some better rights for musicians out of what Shopify has been doing. John, you mentioned before we started recording it, you had a dour take on this whole thing. So why do you hate musicians, John?
I don't hate musicians. I hate to be doom and gloom, because actually I think you and I position were reversed, because this organization is roughly being managed by the same people that did the Amazon live show boycott thing, which I thought was great and you said was pointless. Well, I'm afraid our positions are flip-flopped here. I feel as though this is pointless, and that Spotify is a mammoth, massive company. And the vast majority of their money is not come from Sheer Mag. It doesn't even come from, like, you know, Sonic Youth. You know, their money comes from Taylor Swift. Their music comes from Kanye. Their money comes from Elton John's greatest hits. Their money comes from Billy Joel's greatest hits. Their money comes from Madonna. Like, the vast majority of their money probably comes from – I mean, I'm just making up numbers here. I don't have anything to back this up, but I would say 50% of their income probably comes from, like, 30 artists, honestly. And so it's nice that these people are making this point, but I think the effect is going to be nil, because Spotify is not threatened by – this entire conglomeration of Spotify isn't threatened at all. They might make some nominal gesture that, as we all know, doesn't make any difference at all in the long run. And so I feel this energy could be better spent elsewhere. I'll also point out that in addition to the main things stated here, they have other points on their agenda, which actually might be good cause and good points to do. That being said, it's not necessarily exactly related to this. And therefore, they're discouraging bigger acts from joining this as well and actually having some pull. And not that I'm a Taylor Swift defender or lover or hate. I'm pro Taylor Swift, but I don't really care about Taylor Swift that much. Famously, Taylor Swift held out on Spotify until they gave her a better deal. So Taylor Swift has shown that she's willing to fight with Spotify, which I think is pretty cool. However, this musician union here, they have some what could be considered by some some semi-radical platform basis, you know. So they're discouraging a more mainstream act like Taylor Swift from getting involved with them and helping them out, just because even though she might agree with this principle, there are less important points which are more radical she can't get caught up in. You know, and so I think it's a nice gesture. I don't think it's going to accomplish much. I think maybe the fundamental plan is I feel that the people organizing this are people that just enjoy the act of organizing and aren't really concerned if it'll make an actual change. I think there are more tactical ways you could combat this problem, and the main one is to tell people, don't use Spotify. That's my dour take. And I'm not dissing on any people. What they're doing is good, and it's good in principle. But if they were paying me as an advisor, which they're not, because I don't really know anything about this, but if they were paying me as an advisor, I would say, let's choose a different path or a different tactic to achieve the goal that we want to achieve. Bro.
You punctuate all your stuff now. I've got like two or three thoughts I was trying to sort. And did you ever read on this at all?
Just fuck Spotify. Everyone, like, I don't know. I hope they get what they want. I don't think they're going to unless they have more people behind them. Because it would be good if, you know, like, I read somewhere about it too that they're prepared to escalate the campaign if their demands aren't met, and it didn't say how they'd escalate it. But if they were able to get like larger names to pull out too, like, I think that would be the goal, kind of have everyone present a united front.
Do you guys know what escalate generally means when an entity says escalate?
Molotov no. cocktail.
Yeah. No, this is a term lawyers will use often. A lawyer, I think normal people can, but a lawyer is prohibited from threatening to sue unless they actually have an intention to sue. So, like, you can't say, you better, you know, settle this case or I'll sue you, if you don't have the intention to sue, you can't say that. And some people still do, but you know. So lawyers will sometimes use this funny word called escalate, which seems sinister and means maybe I'll sue you, or maybe I'll just do something else so I don't have to sue you. So generally, a letter from a lawyer, when they say, if you don't respond to this letter, we will escalate the matter. Instead of saying, we'll sue you, they're saying, we might sue you, or we're going to do something else. That's what escalate means, generally.
Is that akin to what you would call like a slap lawsuit kind of thing? Like we're basically, they're trying to...
S-L-A-P-P? S-L-A-P-P?
Yeah.
No, slap and anti. I actually, Adam, one of my very first big wins was I won in the California Court of Appeals, which I defeated an anti-slap suit. Slap is where someone is getting sued for defamation and that person countersues and saying, no, I didn't defame anyone. You're trying to encroach upon my free speech. That's an anti-slap lawsuit.
Oh, okay. I was like, I'm just trying to like put it in the context of like I'm phrasing escalate as like, you know, more lawyers are all of a sudden going to get involved in this, and it's going to cost you money one way or the other, right? Like, it's just going to cost you money to defend yourself. And the fear of that all of a sudden is supposed to...
That's what's implied. Yeah. You know, like, it's like, you know...
Because, I mean, Punk News got scared about that back in, like, in our early days when there was some time where popular teen emo label X at one point, you know, threatened to sue because of like some shit that commenters said. This was back in the days when people couldn't differentiate between like the things published on the website by editors and the things that commenters said. And there was never an actual like lawsuit that happened, but there was like the threat of one and like some like very lawyery cease and desist record letter that we got. And it like scared the pants out of everyone at the time. And it was just like, you know, that whole chilling effect thing. So anyway, Here's my three thoughts on this.
Well, Adam, that is an anti-slap lawsuit. Would be you all suing them for trying to cease your right to free speech.
Ah, well, all we did was just not talk about their stupid bans for 5 years because it was better to be that style about it. All right, so here are my three thoughts here. First of all, Spotify doesn't have any fucking money from doing actual business in the realm that they are in. Like, they're a venture-funded tech company, so a bunch of rich dicks have dumped money into this service for existing, and that's probably where the majority of their money still comes from and originates from. So whatever amount of money they're actually taking in from subscribers and dividing out between people, I think if you took all of the funder money out of the equation, they'd be on far shakier terms. And given that, I don't know exactly how much you'd be able to demand out of them because I don't think they have a business model that would actually hold up to scrutiny. But like tied to that is, I wonder if what the goal is here, like the secret goal is, do you know who does have the money to pay artists to send a stream, John?
Who does have the money to pay artists to send a stream?
Is your buddy's app at Apple, right? Who are Shopify's direct competitor and have the benefit of not having to, you know, pull in venture capital to fund their internet startup because Apple happens to make money from selling iPhones and shit like that. Like that Apple Music exists is. It is just like entirely gravy on top of whatever else they do. So I can entirely see there being something that plays out here that the pressure really starts to build on Spotify for exploiting artists. And then Apple, who at this point does actually pay a better rate than Spotify, but like everyone does, like Amazon even pays a better rate than Spotify. But so Apple right now pays a better rate. But if at some point Apple goes and decides to assert their dominance over Spotify by saying, you know what, we're going to be the bigger company here and we will give a cent a stream to artists because Apple can afford it because they can subsidize it by selling Macs and iPhones and stuff like that. Well, then all of a sudden everyone's in Apple's corner and Apple looks like the fucking hero because again, they can pay for it with their other product lines, and Spotify is just like up Schitt's Creek at that point. And like, I feel like I could see that happen where Apple turns around and they use this to like, to pull some sort of PR power move over Spotify, which again, I like would be kind of neat to see happen because, you know, again, as M iterated, like fuck Spotify, but I don't know if that is the intended effect here. Like the intended effect isn't so much, I think, that artists just get sent to stream. I think the intended effect here is that like all these tech companies start treating the arts with the respect that it deserves. And the fact that you have maybe caused two giant tech companies that are ultimately evil to fight with each other to your benefit is maybe not, it doesn't mean you're getting what you want because, you know, everyone has come to realize that they were wrong. It just means that like someone saw an opportunity to fuck the other guy. So, you know, if that happens, great, but I don't know, it may not be the best of scenarios. But the one thing that is crazy about this to me as a non-Spotify user, and I'm not saying that as my non-streaming user, like I'm an Apple Music user.
Adam, I thought you did use Spotify. No. I don't use Spotify.
No, I thought you did. I've never used Spotify in my life. I think I have an account there because I put the Punk News podcast into their podcast directory. But I couldn't tell you even how to use Spotify. It is an unknown to me. But what I am is I this is not me like getting on my high horse about streaming. Like I pay for Apple Music. I'm an Apple Music person, and if only because all of our other shit is Apple and it just works better as an ecosystem. So, but what that has done is that by being a long-term Apple person is I don't understand firsthand Spotify's like ubiquity in the market. And I'm constantly at odds with like PR people that are writing me to post about their bands on either Punk News or Some Party, because they're always writing me. They're like, this band has 15 million Spotify streams. And I'm like, I don't know what that means. Is that good? Like, I'm not sure. And or I'll have people like that want me to run a premiere, but instead of trying to run the premiere for like a song that is accessible to people, which is to say it's somewhere you don't need to log in to go see, they're like, oh, we want to premiere this song and it's going to like post on Spotify and we want people to like pre-fave it in their Spotify fave file or something like that. And I'm like, I don't know what that is. I don't know how any of this works. What do you want me to do? But I got an email the other day and it just blew my mind because it is the most like 1955 payola email that you could imagine. And it's like, I'm going to read it to you. It's like, hey, I'm inquiring about placement pricing for your Spotify playlist. Now, I want to just subtext this with, I do not have a Spotify playlist, right? But they're like, I'm looking for a 1 month placement for my artist's song. And then they say the song. And they said, we are only interested in top 10 placements. Please let me know if the song meets your playlist standard and how much this would cost. Thanks. And this is from like some dude that works in PR, right? And and they linked to like some song by someone on Spotify that again, I can't play because I don't have Spotify. But like, is that what happens? Like, is that how strong the playlist ecosystem is within the Spotify world? Like, I guess it must be. Like, again, I'm an Apple user. There are playlists and radio stations and things like that in Apple, but they've never seemed like they are. They've always just seemed like adjuncts to the main product. Like the main product is that you have a big library of songs that you can go listen from. And the fact that there are like Apple curated playlists of this or that is there, but it's not something that has ever been top of mind for me. But I don't think that's the case on Spotify. I think that like these Spotify playlists like mean a lot in the universe to most of the population. And I'm sure our listeners are like rolling their eyes being like, what the fuck are you talking about? Did you not realize this? But like, no, I did not realize this. So this guy is like, he wants to find out how much it'll cost for me to put his song in my Spotify playlist. And think, John, that's payola. That is like straight ass, you know, we're going to give the guy at the radio station a bag of money payola.
Realistically, how much do you think you can get?
I want $300. I will make a playlist. I will sign up for Spotify. I will make a playlist. I'll put this guy's song and 9 other songs, so he will have a top 10 playlist or placement or whatever the fuck he wants. And I want $300.
Actually, Adam, you bring up a really good thing, and I want to throw this past UNM. So, Adam, you've got the potential for an expose there. Like, you could really set somebody up for a kick. You know what I mean? Meanwhile, a couple of days ago, I got an email from some PR company, and they're like, Spotify's director of rock is managing a new Spotify program. Do you want to interview Spotify's director of rock? And a part of me is like, yeah, I mean, I could really set them up to like beat the crap out of them, you know? But on the other hand, it's like, is that nice? But on the other hand, Spotify is not a nice company, and they're wreaking havoc on bands, you know? But on the other hand, this is just somebody that needs a job, you know? So would it be fair and interesting if I like set this person up and just beat the crap out of them? Or would that be me being a dick?
Did they send you this request after this whole – Spotify union thing blew up in the news?
Ooh, that's a great question. Let's
like, are they trying to like astroturf some goodwill?
Maybe. Let's look.
I don't understand. Yeah. So I mean, and here's the thing, and like I am sympathetic to the end user here, because again, like the reason I'm an Apple Music subscriber is that it's really fucking convenient that. When I'm making dinner for the family on the weekend, that I can go hook my phone up to the Bluetooth speaker and play this big playlist of the music that I want to play, and not to be either managing an MP3 library or running around changing records. It works in those kind of situations. So I get the convenience level of these things. I understand that. But, like, come on, rich tech assholes. You got to find a way to do this.
October 27th.
Oh, that's way after they got called out. They're trying to leverage you, John.
Oh.
Well, maybe we ought to set them up for a smack. You know what I mean?
Ooh, I think you should. I think you should. All right. So, anyways, that's happening to Spotify. So, good luck. John, we're not gonna get off the lawsuit train just yet here. So, Live Nation, your buddies. So a judge,
my best
has,
friends.
So I mean, hey, well, let's sympathy for Live Nation, because they're probably hurt because of the COVID thing, right? So,
you know, they're just a mom and pop organization.
Just a mom
you know,
and pop, yeah.
They worked their way up, you know, working long hours, you know, when everyone else was relaxing, you know. They really put their own sweat equity into making their company what it is, for sure.
Oh, for sure, yeah. So, real like bootstraps DIY kind of, you know, like a, you know, American dream kind of thing with Live Nation. So, okay, so in 2015, there was a woman whose name was Katie Dix. Now, she died of a drug overdose at an event which was called the 2015 Hard Summer Music Festival in Pinoma, California. And that festival was operated by Live Nation. It was an electronic music festival, I believe. So in a Los Angeles County court, the family of Dix sued Live Nation and the Los Angeles County Fair Association. They were the venue operator, and both the Los Angeles County itself, who was the owner of the fairgrounds, and the city of Pinoma. And they sued all of them for negligence and other claims a year later in 2016. Now, the root of the claims were that Live Nation had a duty to care to prevent, a duty of care to prevent drugs from circulating at their festivals, and they did not do so. And by that resulted in Nix obtaining drugs from a third party at the festival and then passing away from an overdose. So after this, Live Nation, they won their case. They won it via a summary judgment, a motion whereby the court decides there were no questions of fact left to be determined at trial, and therefore issues a judgment prior to trial. Now, the Nix family then filed an appeal, and recently that appeal was granted by the Los Angeles County Judge Dan Thomas Oki. Now, Judge Oki, he found that Live Nation did have a general duty of care for its attendees, increasingly focusing on the electronic element of the festival, and we can get into that in a sec, his order stated in part that an operator of electronic music festivals like Live Nation owes a duty of reasonable care to festival attendees. So next, the matter is going to return to a trial court where the involved parties are going to file additional motions that they may settle the matter or they may proceed to a trial to determine if the defendants are actually liable. John, lots of legalese in this, but I'm reading through this. And again, I'm a lay person. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not even someone that I think has to deal with Live Nation day to day because I don't live in your country. But am I wrong to be kind of sympathetic to the Live Nation position on this?
You're not wrong at all. First of all, it's sad that this young lady passed away. Definitely sad. However, what this is, and honestly, like, I kind of wanted to pull the pleadings on this so we could get it exactly right. I adapted our facts from another website, but I didn't want to spend the money to actually pull the pleadings and waste half an hour to get it exactly right. So basically, they're suing for negligence. Negligence is a tort, which basically means another party had a duty of care to you and did not exercise that care as a reasonable person would. And of course, duties of care and reasonableness can change. For example, if you're in your house and somebody's walking down the street and a tree branch that's not on your property falls down and hits them on the head, are you liable for negligence? No, because you owe no duty of care to that person. Another example, let's say you're in the chainsaw store. I mean, you're in the hardware store and you bring in your chainsaw to get it repaired and you turn it off and there's no gas in it and you leave it on the table and you go somewhere else in the hardware store. And someone else comes along, puts gas on it, turns it on and chainsaws off their leg. Are you liable? No. You have a duty of care to that person because you're in a public place with a chainsaw, but you were reasonable. You took out your gas and someone else was unreasonable and put their gas in. By contrast, let's say you walk into a kindergarten class with a chainsaw and you set it down and a kindergartner gets hurt. You have a duty of care to the kindergartners because you're in the general public area and you were not reasonable because you left the chainsaw where kids could touch it. So what this case is asking is, does a festival have a duty of care to prevent people from willfully engaging in illegal activities? It's clear that a festival has a general duty of care to keep people safe from malicious things. For example, if you're at a festival and you get mugged and the festival didn't check people for weapons, the festival is probably liable. But if they did check people for weapons and just like a mastermind snuck it through, they're probably not liable because they had a duty of care and they were reasonable. They patted people down and they had a metal detector. And this guy was like just super sneaky. However, this is pushing it one step further in that not only do you have a duty to protect people from the atmosphere and not only do you have a duty to protect people from other people, you have a duty to protect people from making their own bad choices. And so originally, from what I can glean, I didn't actually read the case itself, mind you, is the trial level court said, well, no, a festival doesn't have a duty of care to keep someone from buying illegal drugs, you know. Now the other question is, does a bar or does a festival have a duty to not serve an intoxicated person more alcohol? And that varies on a state-by-state basis. I think California, the venue is liable for giving an intoxicated person more alcohol. But that's not the case here. Here, the trial-level court said this person – Live Nation is not liable to keep people from buying drugs for themselves and then using those drugs, which seems reasonable to me. However, this appellate judge, I think he's got it way wrong, and maybe the individual facts of the case are different or something. He's saying that they have a duty to police for drug dealers or people that have drugs, drug sellers, so people don't have the opportunity to buy drugs, which I think is ridiculous. I think that's an excessive duty of care and just way overreaching. And so that spawns the bigger question is, well, if venues have the duty to prevent you from doing things willfully that you, an adult, want to do that you don't, that might be bad for you and you should know bad for you, then what else Do they have a duty to that you can't stand in the sun as long as you want? Do they have a duty to say, oh, you can't mosh because you might get hurt? You know, do they say you can't, you know, talk loudly on the cell phone because it might annoy other people, you know, and get you beat up? You know, it's very much, it's honestly, I mean, I don't mean to be inflammatory, but it is scary. And essentially, this judge is ruling that humans are not capable of controlling themselves and making their own safe decisions. Therefore, we need corporations to make safe decisions for humans, which is a very scary thing. And I don't think the judge realizes the scope of his implication here. And so I think it's a bad ruling. But like I said, I haven't actually read the appeal papers. I think what's probably going to happen is going to go back down to trial level, and I think it'll probably settle. If it went to actual trial, though, I think Live Nation would win, because I think Live Nation could say, listen, we pat people down. We do have metal detectors. We exercise a reasonable duty of care, assuming we have a duty of care to keep people from buying drugs. We have security guards. When they see people smoking weed, they kick them out. You know, that's reasonable. So I think if this went to trial, Live Nation would still win. But certainly, yes, Live Nation, bizarrely, is the more sympathetic party here. And I think this judge is overreaching, going off the facts that we have from third-party sources. And if anybody wants to send me the $12 to download the legal papers and pay me a half hour to review them and give a more qualified and specific answer, I'd be happy to do that.
As minimum wage is, I don't know, let's say charitably $15 an hour, that will cost you $7.50 for John's half hour.
So I'm a minimum wage attorney. The minimum wage attorney.
That's not even the minimum wage, right? Like, that's what people are fighting for. I don't know. I'm not American. Here's my question: is that let's say this went through and Live Nation was you know, found completely guilty and blah 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 blah, right?
Well, Adam, you're not guilty in a civil trial. You are liable, or not liable.
Let's say they're taken to the cleaners, right? Is the worry not that this would have some horrible downstream effect on basically anyone
trying drug dealers?
To have like a public event where suddenly the you know, everyone's insurance all of a sudden skyrockets because you are now liable for all of this like shit that you can't possibly control that humans are going to potentially do to each other?
And not only that, is nobody wants to be the small vet, nobody wants to be the bar where somebody gets some speed and ODs on speed, and now the bar is liable because you bought some speed from a guy that wasn't supposed to have speed to begin with. You know what I mean? Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It's stupid.
This is the thing that to me as an adult has been the worst realization is. Because when you're young and idealistic, you want to do all this stuff, and you think that, like, man, if I had the means, then you know I could make cool things happen in the world. What I've come to realize is that, you know, as I get into the age in my life where I could potentially have the means to make cool things happen in the world, you probably can't because the insurance would be too high, and that's the bit, like, because I've thought about it at the time, like, man, like, there's nowhere in Niagara Falls where you can go see like cool punk shows. Like let's say COVID is done and we can actually go to places again, right? Like, there's nowhere you go see punk shows. I should open the venue where you can go see punk shows. And then I'm like, no. Like, think about what the insurance would cost to run that kind of operation. Like, fuck that. Like, it ain't gonna happen, right? And like, all my idealistic, like, I'm gonna make the world cooler plans always sort of run up against, like, but do you know how much insurance would cost? And I feel like this is one of these things where it's like, yeah, this is the reason why insurance costs so much.
Adam, check this out. This is going to blow your mind. Is I've considered getting insurance for some shows that I've thrown, aside from venue insurance, which exists. Like you can insure an event as opposed to a venue. And when you go to do that, like there's a bunch of different companies that say, yes, insure your event. And it'll be like, what music do you play? What music is going to be there? Country, disco, dance, punk? If you click punk, they won't insure you.
This is actually a social political issue within the Toronto music scene, because there's like a systemic bias that happens where this applies to, I think, both insurance and to both like what venues are willing to book, where there's a lot of venues that will not book straight hip hop shows because they are running on this misguided assumption that, oh, there's potential for more violence if we have a hip-hop show, and it's going to cost us more on insurance and whatever else, and they won't do it. And it totally fucks with the hip-hop community in Toronto. Thing that happens. So, yeah, I don't know. Where do we... What should we do about this? What should we wish for to happen here? Because on the one hand, we reflexively want Live Nation to get fucked at all moments. But I feel that if we wish for that here, it potentially bites the rest of us in the ass somehow.
Yeah, don't cut your nose to spite your face.
There you go. Em, you got a feel on this? Sorry, we kind of dominated that.
No, it's no problem. No, the only thing that I thought of was the security, because there was something with, like, she went down and security didn't do anything. Like, they didn't react. And then when, first responders showed up, it was after 20 minutes. And in that, you know, space of time, every second counts and every second makes a difference. So, you know, one thing that would be good that if anything does come out of this would be to hire security that has training, because it's an electronic music festival. You have an idea, like, kind of what might be floating around, you know? So if you're prepared and you have people who are around, like, okay, keep an eye out if, you know, someone is, in distress, here's what you can do. I think that would be one good thing that would come out of it.
I never want to take, like, I always feel that, like, putting on a libertarian hat is a dirty thing, and I don't want to do it. But, like, I keep thinking about, like, having to do one of these things, and with how much of a personal crisis that you get into if you OD on something, and how, as the, you know, small handful of people running one of these events, like, maybe not an event this big, but let's say a club show or something like that, like, how could you possibly keep track of what everyone is doing, you know, in that room, in those bathrooms, in wherever else, and be able to, like, you know, you'd like to think that you've got a bunch of, you know, naloxone at, is that what it's called, whatever it is?
Narcan?
Probably has a couple of names. Whatever it is, if you're having like an oxy OD, they can zap you back to life, right? Whatever that shit is, like, you'd like to think that you got some of those behind the bar, so you are, like, you know, reasonably stocked. But if someone, like, you know, fucks off into a corner and disappears from sight, and they have a problem, like, geez, how do you? At what point does it stop being your problem and start being their problem? That is a thing.
I'm not trying to be cruel, and if people want to have Narcan, I think that's a good idea, but I don't even know why you should have to have, like, why should you have to plan for people to commit illegal things, and then as they commit illegal things, you have to make sure that they're okay afterwards, you know?
Well, I mean, I'm okay with having a few of these things prevent, like, from a prevention standpoint, but the cynical read on it, or maybe the realistic read on it, is that you don't want to end up in court, right? So...
Yeah,
you got it stocked. I don't know. It's weird. I feel weird rooting for Live Nation in anything, but
man, 2020 is mixing up everything. We're like, yeah, go Live Nation.
Yeah, so I don't know. Anyways, here we go. We'll do one more, and then we'll do a song here. So, Danny Elfman of Oingo Boingo of film and television soundtrack composition, Danny Elfman of the Simpsons theme song. He has released his first solo pop song in over 35 years. It is called Happy. You can find it streaming out on Punk News right now. It's on YouTube if you want to go look it up there. The track includes contributions from drummer for everyone Josh Fries, from Deathlock guitarist
I think it's Nilly Broche.
Nilly Broche and Dub Trio bassist Stu Brooks. Now, the interesting thing here, too, is that Elfman has signed to Anti, the mature sub-label of Epitaph Records. And he's going to have a a new record coming out next year. So he's jumping right back into the into the alt pop world of things. And maybe more important, Danny Elfman is surprisingly jacked.
Right.
Oh yeah, there's a photo that kind of ran with this, and despite the fact that he has a little bit of like a Carrot Top vibe right now, which is a little bit concerning. He's huge, and so he's got that going for him. John, what the fuck is going on here?
Well, I was like, does he actually have a whole tribal sleeve? And did it, like last year, he didn't have a tribal sleeve and he wasn't jacked. So we pulled a Dr. Dre where he got like mega jacked in like 10 months, maybe over COVID. Yeah, and now he's got a full sleeve as well. The weird thing is like Danny Elfman was always like this little string bean of a guy. And he's like 60 now and he's like a bruiser. It's crazy. First of all, if you haven't heard the first Oingo Boingo album, Only a Lad, pause this, run out and listen to that now. Only a Lad by Oingo Boingo, classic. If you like Devo, you will love Oingo Boingo because they have a similar vibe to Devo, except for whereas Devo is like, we're sane and everyone else is getting dumber, Oingo Boingo is Danny Elfman saying, I'm insane and the entire world is sane. So it's kind of like the flip perspective. So anyway, Oingo Boingo is awesome. Plus he wrote the Batman theme song. I thought this video was friggin' awesome. Like I'm not a huge Danny Elfman fan. I like Oingo Boingo's earliest stuff. I like his stuff in his movies and stuff, but I know he's got a huge fan base. I like Danny Elfman, but I'm not a maniac, but I thought this video was really, really cool. I really liked how his face is like, done like a late 90s computer program, so it like really hits that uncanny valley. I did think maybe some of the computer effects were unnecessary and it made it look cheaper and cheater than it needed to be. I thought really almost just the CGI face in of itself was enough. And then it like changes to his real face and then twists. I thought that was super cool. I think the song itself is really cool. And I think at the end, he used the F word a lot, which I think is not necessary. I don't think he needed it. And it verges on a little like Nine Inch Nails-ish sort of, which I thought maybe he didn't. I think maybe the song itself was super strong and didn't need those effects. But that being said, I'm really excited for this and I'm excited for this album. And I thought the song was honestly like pretty cool, pretty dark. And I mean, it's goth. It's a goth track. So I would love for Danny Elfman to make a straight up goth album like this track implies. And also I will say this, like when he's released solo stuff before Oingo Boingo stuff, especially the second half of Oingo Boingo, it was much more kind of relaxed isn't the right word, but measured, calm, subtle, and you know, mature, if you will. Whereas this is kind of leaning back to his most frantic, crazy days where he's kind of portraying this, you know, crazy character that flips back and forth between personalities, which I dig a lot. The one thing I will say though is everyone's making a big deal. Oh, the first Danny Elfman track in 35 years is so cool, and it is cool. But listening to the song, like it didn't really sound that different than the songs on Nightmare Before Christmas or some of the other stuff that he's written. And I don't mean that as a diss. I'm just saying is I think he's been writing Danny Elfman pop songs all along. That they've just been in movies. You know what I mean? But I dug this.
What do you think, Em?
The video freaked me right out. Because, like, so I liked it. It was really cool. But when it starts and it's just his face and, like, it's the screen's black behind him and then his mouse moving and then, oh, I don't know. It got me for some reason. But, like, the more I watched it, like, the better, you know, like, it's creepy, but it's, like, it's a good level of creepy. You know, it all works. And then I didn't mind the song at all. I thought it was pretty cool. And then how it kind of feels like it's one song, but it feels very distinct where there's a before and then a split and then it kind of goes back. So I thought that was really interesting how he did that. I don't know. If I listened to the full album, but I definitely listen to more songs.
I'm curious about where I'm going with this myself. I'm not sure if I'm not sure if I'm if I'm more fascinated with it than I am actually enjoying it as a piece of music in and of itself. So, you know, the jury's out on that. But we'll see. Danny Elfman is back in play. So there you go. John, you want to play something?
Sure. I'm going to... I'm loathe to play anything Canadian on the Punk News podcast because Adam White's like, oh, I'm only playing Canadian stuff from now on. Canada. That'd be like if I was like, USA, yeehaw, what was the phrase they say? No, not Pride, Not Prejudice. I'm thinking of Pride and Prejudice. What do they say? History, not hatred or whatever. You know, I feel that if I did what Adam did for USA, that's how I would come across. That being said, despite Canada's flaws, they have made some good music. There's a relatively unknown band called the Dub Rifles. Adam and M, do you guys know the Dub Rifles?
I do not.
Well, John, I'm going to really fuck you up here, but only in that you played a Dub Rifles song not too long ago. Continue.
Oh, I did?
Yes.
Oh, well, then I'm not playing the Dub Rifles anymore. I forgot that I did. So I will play a track by something that's cool. I will play I made a big deal about play. Check this out. I'll play something else that's Canadian just because I spent the last 50 minutes beating down on Canada. Let's play that awesome band from Canada with the guy he was called Nazi Dog, but he wasn't actually a Nazi. What's that band?
Vile Tones.
Vile Tones. I'll play some. This is some Vile Tones straight out of Canada, just for Adam.
Tones. I wasn't expecting that. All right, cool. So we had a few more stories here that we want to touch on. So first of all, there was a breakup. This was a alt tentacles band that is in very much in the John universe. So John, you take this one. What's going on?
Yeah, La Machina, which you would think it'd be La Machina, but it's actually La Machina. They broke up. La Machina is Susie Moon of the Turbulent Hearts. Ricky Sticks of Death Valley Girls and the Darts, and Michelle Valderrama of the Darts as well. They formed this super group, and there was some buzz going around this group. I don't know if the buzz was just because people were like, oh, these three bands are together, or I don't know if the buzz was because people were genuinely excited, or I don't know if the buzz was because there was buzz, as sometimes tends to happen. But there was a fair amount of buzz with regards to this band, and they sold out of their 7-inch within like a week, which that's saying something. And so they actually were at least halfway recording the full album. Maybe they almost done the whole thing. And just last week, they posted a video. They're like, here's our new video. And it was a kind of video that they put of Their videos aren't throwaway videos. Their videos have like a lot of material, like a lot of work put into them. And so like every other day, they're like, oh, we're best friends. Oh, we're recording this album. It's so exciting. We love being La Machina. This is great. And then like 3 days later, they're like, we broke up. Don't ask us about it. We're not putting out the album. That goodbye, you know. And so it was like a super abrupt like end of the band, and it always makes you wonder what could have possibly happened. They were like best friends 4 days ago, and all I can take from this, Adam, is whenever like actually at this point, I think Adam, you and I have seen this time and time again. Whenever a band like shows like them like in like a van together, and they're all like laughing and smiling, like love playing with my best friends, you know, or the like, oh, you know, that's when you know a band is going to break up. I mean, we've seen this like. Adam, I know I can think of like five bands where I've seen them like, we're best friends, we're all pals, I love being in this band. And then like 3 days later, we all hate each other. Don't ask us about it. We're never talking about this band again. And you have to wonder, like I don't know what could possibly happen between three people. I can only think of one thing that would cause such a breakup, which I know caused the breakup of one band, but I'm 99.9999% sure that's not the case here. So I can't fathom what would cause such a we're all best friends and we all hate each other. Don't ever talk to us about this ever again. I mean, it happens a lot in bands, and, you know, because like being a band is like being in a marriage with three other people, you know, I guess. But it's meant to go from that palsy wowsy to all we hate each other in like a second, you know. I was shocked. And were you shocked by this?
Very. It seemed to come out of absolutely nowhere. Like they're, you know, they have their video out. They're all getting all set up. Like the energy's going, the momentum's kind of started, and then it's nope, we're done. That's it. Goodbye.
What do you think happened?
They had a tontine, like the flying hellfish, and they realized that if they all remained in the same band, one of them was going to kill the other one, so they could get the Nazi stolen art. That's the only explanation.
Makes sense.
All three members of the band are very talented. Susie sang Happy Days on Punk News Podcast 500. And honestly, I was like really surprised with how good it came out. Like it sounded like really good. So I'm sure they'll go on to do other cool stuff, all three of them. So, well, listen, it happens, man.
All right. On a completely separate side of things, the iconic Japanese hardcore punkers. I always want to say Gizm, but you pronounced them differently, didn't you?
No, I say gee. I think it actually is jism. Like I think it's jism, like sperm. But like cool people that I know say geezum because I think they're embarrassed that it is jism. And jism is usually spelled with a J. Jism is usually J-I-S-M.
It's like people that pronounce like Uranus, like Uranus.
So right. So I think they say – so I say geezum just to be cool, even though I'm not. So jism, geezum, whatever.
Whatever you want to call them. Anyways, they've reissued their first album. Detestation. It's out through Relapse Records. The new version includes remastered sound, three bonus tracks taken from compilations that had come out at about the times. The digital version's out now. The physical version is going to be out in December. This is the band's very first official release of the LP in North America. Authorized reissues in Japan have also been released in a very limited basis previously. And you can stream the whole thing right now. On the internets there. So there is a reissue of this classic Japanese hardcore band. John, this is a band that I've never delved into, but I hear people talking about all the time. Like this is a band that I feel like fucked up references all the time. Like everyone in the kind of like cool hardcore world is really fucking into Gizm.
Yeah, honestly, it comes in waves. Like every 4 years, people all the cool people at punk scene be like, oh, I love Japanese hardcore, you know, I love Gizm, I love Zao, I love Galze, you know, or they get even some of the more obscure bands like Hoko and those kinds of bands. But Gizm is like the creme is considered the creme de la creme of Japanese hardcore because of the weirdest as well. And so every 4 years, everyone gets back into Gizm and Japanese hardcore. Gizm is an awesome band. The first record is their best, Detestation. And it is a weird like we actually talked about this on the Punk Podcast about 2 years ago when I first kind of got into it. It's a weird I didn't understand it at first. And honestly, I think this record is kind of the reason why people have certain views of what Japanese hardcore might be but actually isn't. Like, because everybody in DDS Chasing dresses like they're a Motley Crue, but then they play like this super dark hardcore and the satanic punk. But also the main guy, Sakibi, he's like literally insane, and like he's been arrested for like attacking people in the subway and stuff. And so his lyrics are just so weird, but also his delivery is like super weird. So that's Gizem. Everyone should check out Gizem. They're a very, very interesting band. The new mix, I guess the remix by Relapse. And also, I mean, the record itself, if you get an OG copy of the record, it's like a $700 record. And this is the first Relapse, and it was the first ever re-release of the record, but that's not true, which we'll get into in a second, because two other versions have been released in Japan. But the Relapse remix is actually pretty radical in that, like, the record itself is famously murky and dusty and muddy, and they really cleaned it up, and you can hear a lot of things that you couldn't hear before, and you can say that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. I think it sounds really good, and it's probably the best presentation of the record so far. But there's one big thing that everyone is turning a blind eye to it, and I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. And we're going to address this from the lesser thing and then the greater thing. Adam, if you look at the pre-sale, you'll see there's an OV strip on the record, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Do you know why that OV strip is there, particularly because the original version didn't come with an OV strip, so it's weird to put an OV strip on it now?
Is it to make it look more Japanese to the North American audience?
It's to hide a giant swastika on the album cover. Ooh. And you could say, now you can make the argument, that, well, they're not putting the swastika there because they like Nazis or whatever. And you know, it is interesting how the swastika has a different – we discussed this, how in America the swastika has somewhat of a different meaning than it does in England, just conceptually to the average person. In Japan, I'm sure it's different over there too because of the entirely different history and, you know, the side that they were on in World War II. So there's a swastika on the cover. But you can make the argument, well, the swastika isn't there to say Nazis are cool or whatever. The swastika is there to show images of power and also to comment on the horrors of war. Of course, famously, the Melvins and many other bands have put swastikas on their album covers. But the Melvins did a swastika on one side of the record and a cross on the other side. And, of course, because Buzz Osborne, I think, is half Jewish, it's clear that the Melvins aren't Nazis. They're just commenting on symbolism and those kinds of things, you know. So you could say, well, they don't actually mean the Nazis are cool. They're just using that symbolism as kind of a statement. However, there's a 2015 version of the record called Determination, which is the rough mix of Detestation, and it was put out directly by Gizem, Beastarts, which is Sakibi's label. Directly on the album cover. The album cover is Sakibi is a very interesting collage. What he does is he does these super whacked out collages. And on the cover is a collage of what is essentially a Crash style collage in color that's a war zone, basically, and has commentary in the form of collage on it. However, in bright white letters, and this is at the bottom on the album cover, and this is me quoting things. This is not me saying it. This is me quoting the cover of Gizem's album cover. Privately owned international Jew banks finance both sides in a war, making a killing from military spending. And so
that's my new ringtone, guys.
It's hard to spin that. It's hard to spin that to say that, well, Sakibi doesn't mean that. He's just using that as an artistic statement. You know what I mean? And that's right on the album cover. It's difficult to interpret that as anything but it being meant genuinely and not, I don't know, ironically or abstractly or something. And even if he doesn't mean it literally, and even if he just is doing it there to be weird or shocking, certainly many other bands have been broken and destroyed for lesser crimes, if you will. And I think maybe he does mean, but I don't know. But maybe he does mean that. The point being is everyone is kind of turning a blind eye to Gizem and giving them a pass when other bands have been broken. And like I said, we don't really know until Sakibi gives an interview about it, and he doesn't really do interviews, I don't think. But then there's the other thing is, as we recall with Tal Cross, about a year ago, Tal Cross was going to put out a record. And in the record, Rob Miller thanked Gerard Menowin, who was a Holocaust denier. And, of course, Holocaust denial, Gerard Menowin, not cool at all, definitely wrong. And but what label was that on, Adam?
I don't know. What label was that on?
Relapse.
Oh, shit.
Relapse.
All right.
And Relapse made like a huge deal about how we, and maybe they were right to, I'm not saying they were right to or they were wrong. You know, they made a huge deal about how we can't have, the, we're not putting out this record because he thanks a Holocaust denier in the records. And to Rob Miller's, I don't want to say his credit, but he ambiguously said he was not a Holocaust denier, but wouldn't say he wasn't a Holocaust denier. He was very unclear about it, you know. So, but this was a huge offense to Relapse. And from Relapse perspective, all right, I get it. You don't want to get caught up in that jam. You think it's abhorrent. I get you. That I understand. But then you're putting out Geezum, who literally said on their album cover, this is me quoting again, this is me quoting Geezum, privately owned international Jew banks financed both sides in the war, making a killing from military spending. I don't see any way you can rectify those two things.
It is an interesting, must be an interesting day at like Relapse's office when this type of issue crops up a few times a year and they have like, you know.
But then, I mean, I'm sure they know that they knew, like, the Rob Miller, I think, was a surprise to everybody. Like, for like the Amoebus guy thinking a Holocaust denier, that's weird. But this problem has been with Geezum since they began. Especially since they put the swastika on the album and a couple other weird things here or there. So this is a problem that has been attached to Geezum, but there is no clear answer. And people, I mean, punks that attend anti-racism marches will wear a Geezum backpatch, but it's like, well, I don't know, man. You know, people just kind of turn a blind eye. Is it because they're Japanese? Is it because people don't know? Is it because people don't care? I don't know. Is it because the music's so good that people are willing to overlook it? You know, like Led Zeppelin, although Led Zeppelin never said anything as bad as that. But
I'm lashing onto this like we can solve all of our problematic issues with more Obi strips, though.
Oh no, the guy's a white power skinhead. Obi strips.
Yeah, throw another couple on there. Right?
Oh no, the guy's been arrested for sex trafficking. Obi strips.
Just cover it all up. John, you know so much more about Geezum than I do that I want to weigh in on this. But yeah, I don't know, man. Like in the one hand, like I feel for what like Relapse is trying to do, right? Like they're one of these labels that like they have the size and the credibility to go and to take some of these legendary records by these legendary artists and get them back out into the world and do something with them. But at the same time, they probably have some really shitty board meetings where they sit around and figure out what the fuck they're going to do about this or that, you know, questionable aspect that has come up from one of these maniacs that they're releasing a record from. It is probably not easy.
But what's frustrating is they took such a moral stand against Talcross, which I understand. But when a significantly – oh, actually, there's one thing I want to add about this. When a band that will make significantly more money than Talcross comes in, oh, it's not even an issue. You know what I mean?
No, I mean, yeah, I get that. I don't know.
What I will add is the pre-order for this was crazy. The pre-order was so crazy, it shut down the entire Relapse website for like a day. They were like frantically finding other places on the internet, like Bandcamp and other stuff, to like sell stuff. And as soon as they would put it up there, it crashed the system again. I think they sold like 5,000 to 10,000 copies in a day. Which is insane for any record, except for like Beyonce, you know, like in one day they sold like 5,000 to 10,000 copies of a record. That's ridiculous.
That's probably why they were they had a little bit different rules than the other one. So yeah. So anyways, this is out. You could be one of the many people that own one. So here's the real question, John. Is that Obi strip? Is it a real Obi strip? Like, could you take it off?
It is a real Obi strip. But what's amusing about it is the Obi strip technically is supposed to go on the far left edge of the record, but because they had to cover up the swastika, they shimmied it like about 3 inches further to the right than it generally goes.
Well, when I had my my little tape compilation that I did put together. That was one of the options from the tape place, was that I could get an Obi strip on it. And it made no sense, like, money-wise to do so. But, man, did I sit there and think about it for a while, because I'm just like, there is nothing cooler than one of those little bands, man. It has nothing to do, like, complete cultural appropriation for me to do one, but woof, did I want one.
Why is that called? That's not cultural appropriation. Well,
in that you'd figure that, it is an affectation of a release in Japan.
Is making a CD cultural appropriation, Adam? Because that was made in Japan. Is that cultural appropriation?
No,
making a
CD? Sticking something that is distinctive of a Japanese release on my non-Japanese release just because I think they're neat is, I wouldn't say, you know, it's not problematic. Cultural appropriation.
So we're not allowed to be. We're not allowed to be influenced by other cultures. And also, you know, Japan is not the only country that does Obi strips, mind you.
Questionable use of my money, cultural appropriation. Why was there Obi strips on the Punk News tapes?
There wasn't.
You should have done. They're awesome. Anyways, we're running super long. I'm going to get a couple of these more stories in because they're important. There's a dude, John. His name was Paris Mayhew. He played for a band that you may have known called the Cro-Mags during their initial run.
I think I've heard of that.
Yeah, Cro-Mags, right? you should listen to them. So he started a new band. The new band is called Agros. They have a debut song out. It's called Chaos Magic. You can stream it right now. It is streaming over at a Metal Injection. You can find the link, of course, on Punk News to that. Now, it is a completely instrumental hardcore track.
And it's 7 minutes.
It is 6-7 minutes long. It goes on for a little while. It's one of these things that I made the mistake of going to listen to like a minute before we started recording the show. And then I looked at the time in the little YouTube video and I was just like, God fucking damn it. So he's going to plan to release a bunch of singles. Each single is going to come with a video. John, I got a bunch of thoughts about this. It is a very New York, kind of video. there are definitely some like Adidas tracksuits that are happening in there. But it is also amusingly a completely instrumental piece of hardcore music to which, as you get to say 2 or 3 minutes into it, you can't help but start just making up your own lyrics to go with it. At least that's what happened to me. John, is this up your alley? It must be.
Yeah. Yes. I agree with Adam, and I think we should record our own version, or each, maybe all three of us should do our own dueling versions of this, or maybe we should do dueling versions of like 1 minute of it and give it our own track, our own lyrics. What I will say was like the Cro-Mags battle is always John Joseph or Harley. Who wrote the music? Who wrote the lyrics? But Paris often gets overlooked in that battle. And Harley often has said that Paris was also a main contributor, although now that Paris and Harley don't get along, Harley has somewhat not brought that up as much. And so the question is, you know, with a lot of the post-Age of Quarrel records, the magic is somewhat gone. And so you're like, well, who where did the magic come from? Who's the real source? And Harley's recent stuff has been fantastic. And so the answer had been like, oh, well, it was Harley all along, because his recent solo stuff and the recent Cro-Mags record, excellent. That being said, you hear this, and this is the classic Cro-Mags sound. And it's like, well, maybe it was Paris who was a big part of this, the sound. And honestly, I think the reality is both Harley and Paris were kind of mutually a big part of the sound. And so now each when they record music, either intentionally or just by osmosis, they take the elements the other developed and each make their own music. And that's why it sounds, both sound like the magic of the Cro-Mags. Harley sounds like the magic of the Cro-Mags. And so does Paris with that big, you know, wah, wah, wah. The one thing that I will say Harley has over Paris, and I'm not trying to start a beef here, is I think Harley's a better songwriter, but both lyrically and song-wise. Harley's songs usually about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes. This song is 7 minutes. It doesn't need to be 7 minutes. The reason it's 7 minutes is because Paris is an excellent musician, and musicians love to just keep playing and playing and playing, but that doesn't always translate to good listening. And also, I got to say, it sounds awesome, but what I want to hear an album of instrumental Cro-Mags music, no, I want lyrics on top of that. It's specifically, I want Harley's lyrics on top of that. So I think it's interesting. I think it's kind of funny how for 7 minutes, it just actually, well, it is cool how it shows Paris and different phases of his career. And he still looks exactly the same now as he did 30 years ago, which is cool. But I do like how the whole video is just Paris like staring like meanly while subway cars like fly past. He's like, and now I'm staring this way. And now I'm staring that way. And now I'm staring at you. And now I'm staring this way. He's like, what are you staring at, man? But yeah, so I mean, it's cool, but, I think it needs a little song. The musicianship is excellent. The riffs are excellent, but I think it needs a little songwriting craft. And I would prefer some lyrics and more. Were you headbanging to this? Were you moshing to this?
I kept wait. I know it said it was instrumental, but I kept waiting for like lyrics to start, and then it didn't. And I was like, oh yeah, because it's instrumental. And then just kind of like went with it. And yeah, like the musicianship's great. It sounds really cool. I probably wouldn't listen to an album of instrumental stuff, but like it does sound really neat. The thing in the video where he's on a pedal bike, that was the best.
the most hardcore of. Yeah, personal conveyances right there.
Yeah.
So anyways, yeah, I'm curious to see like what an instrumental hardcore record full of like 6 minute songs would work like in its entirety. Like, did you get into some sort of weird like post-rock, like Godspeed You Black Emperor kind of like world at a certain point of that? Because like I won't listen to a Godspeed record and think to myself like, where's the lyrics? But I kept listening to this and like waiting for someone to start like screaming all of a sudden, and it didn't happen.
I need the lyrics, man. I mean, I can take like one or two instrumental tracks in an album, but I need the lyrics, man. Give me the lyrics. Give me the vocals.
All right. Well, here's a song with some vocals. We're going to we'll end this off with just some good news, because everything that Mike Park does is good news in our book. So, Mike Park, you know, Asian Man Records, Skank and Pickle, the Chinkies, Mike Park. So, him and Catbite have got together and they've released a song. The song is called You Feel Like You're in Quicksand. So you can go check out, it has a video, it's on YouTube. We've got a link up on Punk News. Not a whole lot to say in particular outside of that fact that Catbite are John's buddies. At least I've decided they are. Mike Park is buddies of everybody in the universe, and the two go very well together. This is a very nice kind of like classic feeling, kind of like ska tune. What do you think, John?
I think it's rad. I think Catbite is rad. Catbite have played two Punk News events, and they are among the coolest and best new bands or newish bands in the Philly and North American punk and punkish scenes. It's rad.
There you go. Time to check it out.
Yeah, it's really fun. It's really upbeat. It's just good. It's like a ray of sunshine.
Maybe we'll just leave that podcast, thepunknews.org, if you want to email us. We'll see you next week. Whenever that happens again, time has no meaning.